Usually in the Mahamudra tradition, a teacher would never start a teaching without going for refuge, yeah? Without at least referring to Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha, as you are familiar with the triple refuge. And when a teacher gives explanations, then of course, we need to be in the refuge. It is not a personal thing to offer the Dharma. It has to be the refuge. Yes? You don't hear me? This is because here we have quite a strong sound here in the front. Is there something? I mean, this could be okay for you? No? Still not? Oh, there's a whole row back there who don't hear properly. You see, the micro is now in ideal position. What can we do? So I will continue. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. This will be another mantra I will teach to you. Om Mani Padme Hum. You know it already. Of course you know. Oh, there is a... Now I hear myself in quite a resonance. Double. I feel like... Okay. So you see, you will go a little bit forth and back and until you find the good sound. Yes? Yeah, because I do know, now your thumbs are up and here it is bearable. So we can do like that. Yes? Okay. And I do know that when I guide meditations, especially my voice sometimes drops at the end of the sentence, so I try to correct that. It's been a lifetime challenge for me to correct that, but I'm getting better. I'm working on it. Back to the refuge, you know. It will be part of the teaching, go a little bit deeper with the meaning of what is called the safe place. And I'm aware that safe place, the safe direction to take, means a lot in a country where there's so much danger. Yes, so much going on. What is a safe place? And well, since I'm at it, the safe place is when, like now, the focus goes inwards. Goes inwards to that mind of now. Now, right now, where there is this spaciousness from which anything can arise. Can you feel that in your mind? There is an openness, we sometimes call it. You go inwards, especially when there is a gap between my words. You feel the potential of the next experience. Yeah? Do you feel something is arising? Yes? You're ready for whatever arises in the next moment. And in that space, if you can relax into that space, I make this movement with my hands a little bit backwards, because normally with our clinging mind and also with the fearful mind, we are in a forwards bend. We grasp, we hold on to security, we want something, we want something nice. So this movement is a movement of trust, you find, that's the dimension from which everything arises. It's open, it's dynamic. There's the potential for the whole world arising from within there. And it is receptive. It is interactive. Our mind is by nature interactive. Or the five outer senses, the inner sense of knowing ourselves, but also look at your emotional radar which you're having, this antenna which you have to feel a situation. It's all there. It's an incredible potential in there of receptivity and of expressivity, to express, to create. We would call that answering to what we feel, to what we receive. It's a constant process in which we are feeling, receiving, and answering, being in that situation in a spontaneous way, flowing back into it as we are receiving more, we flow. There's a constant process of this interbeing, Thich Nhat Hanh would call it. Maybe you can use that, maybe you can translate it to yourself. What would be a good way, sorry if I turn to you to disturb you, but what would be a good way, because this is so, this interbeing is so wonderful how Thich Nhat Hanh has coined that word.
Yeah, maybe we say shluviyot or shluviyut. Everybody knows this word, no? Interbeing.
You know, okay.
So, inter are.
Good, good. You know, this is good because being is, you know, it sounds like just being, and one doesn't know that we are a field. We are actually, we are not a being which is a closed being. It's impossible. We need to breathe. The next breath already connected. We need to eat. We need to drink. We offer our leftovers to the world. Yes? Interbeing. All the time. We look. And when we look, we don't only see colors. I see your interest in the face. I see almost, I see that you are reflecting on what you hear. You can, we receive so much more when we see. You hear not only sounds, you hear maybe the how my mind is vibrating behind the sounds that are coming out. The sounds are just carrying the vibration of that heart mind, you can say. So this is what we call interbeing, constantly in a process of exchanging, of receiving and offering, taking our place in this world, breathing, whatever I do, for example, here moving the hands, that's interaction with the air, that's interaction with your eyes, this is interaction with your sensitivity. Nothing is without an effect. And so this is actually where the true refuge is. You might wonder, how is that possible? It is the true refuge because it is exactly that which stays when we leave our body. When we die, it is that which stays. It is that interbeing which continues, that sensitivity, that spacious, open dimension, which is basically communicative. The Buddhist teaching calls that compassion. Yes? Compassion means in receptivity which understands and which answers. So there is a response. Compassion is offering a response to the world based on our understanding, which is wisdom. Compassionate wisdom is this interbeing that Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about. And to be familiar with that and to know that there is no center in that. It is a centerless, completely open dimension of being without this nice knot that we think to be the I, the self. It's not to be, cannot be found. It is even that so-called self, which we can use, is interbeing. Yourself and myself, we can talk to each other, you and me, but at the same moment we are using this word, we are in this interbeing, we are in this exchange process. And this is the real refuge. And we can elaborate on that, we can give it names, you know, we can talk about the three kayas in the Tibetan tradition, the three bodies of a Buddha. But basically we are just describing that. Open, dynamic, creative. And some of you who are familiar with the theistic traditions, you will think, well, that's exactly how they describe God. If we go into depth, what is really meant? Oh, they talk also about the Trinity, and it's very, very similar. So that's, we are going to a common refuge, to a common place of safety. And before here you lived the terrible attack of the Hamas, there was the war in Ukraine, right? And I communicated, of course, with my Russian friends, Ukrainian people, how to practice when you sit in a subway, in a metro, as the only safe place to be, how to practice there. One has to know that refuge. You know, I'm getting shivers when I talk to you. I'm getting goosebumps when I enter that. I can feel your reaction. That's my reaction, my sensitivity to what is happening now in the room when I touch on the subject, right? So, what to do? And then we need to know where to go with our mind. And it is this, not this closing protection. It won't work because the forces around are stronger. They will kind of penetrate all our protections. Impossible. So I was sitting with them, I was in a Vipassana, in the Mahamudra Vipassana retreat in Beatenberg in Switzerland, guiding that retreat when the attack of the Russians on the Ukraine happened. And I had to inform the retreatants about that. And immediately we meditated with everyone. Yes? And we went into that situation, and I do it a little bit with you at the beginning of this teaching, to trust that open dimension in us where nothing needs to be defended, because we are like space. And everything just moves through and dissolves in that space. And yes, there can be a creative response. Yes, there is interbeing, but those movements of our emotions, of our thoughts, they are like drawings in the sky. That is a famous Mahamudra example, drawings in the sky. All the trauma you have lived, all the difficult emotions, you know, right now, in the mind of now, drawings in the sky. If you want, drawings in the water. It's also possible. If we had a pond here, I would go with you to the pond and I would ask you to draw a big circle with your finger in the water. The beginning of the circle dissolves already as you turn your finger, and it's difficult to join the circle, because it's the beginning is not there anymore. And this is the nature of our mind. And that's basically where we are going with these Mahamudra teachings. It's coming home into that which is our true refuge. It is not an easy journey, because letting go, opening up, becoming so permeable. So, permeable, maybe it's a word we need to translate, or it's like, you know, when things go through and there's no resistance, you know, this kind of inner openness.
המילה, המילה זה חדיר, הכל נכנס פנימה, הכל עובר דרכנו.
Okay, this permeability is the solution, not to make our mind a fortress, because all fortresses we have seen, they crumble at some point. So this is where we find the real peace, is when the mind becomes open, fluid, sensitive, yes, and I do also. I mean, this doesn't mean that one doesn't feel pain, you know, it's all there, it's all there. But then comes the next moment of now. And if we allow the pain to move on, that is the moment, like this morning when I sat out there in the early morning on this beautiful new fresh bench smelling of fresh wood, and I was thinking, this hasn't been here for long, otherwise it wouldn't smell like that. And I was drinking my water and being with just that. And you can do that. I know your mind is just like mine. I know it's not different. There is the possibility to always come back into the now. And the now means that one sits, for example, in the subway in Kiev, and there are people huddling together, they hold each other, and the moment of now is a moment of love and compassion. And yes, that's also true. It's not negating the rest, but it is the truth that mind is moving on and is naturally loving, naturally full of compassion. So I would love to share that with you, so that encouragement to always move on, whatever happens. The worst hasn't happened yet to us. We are still here. Yes, it hasn't happened yet. Both my parents lived the Second World War. My mother had her hairs on flames and in the bombs and so on, you know. I won't give all the stories. You have so many stories also. Your ancestors, my God. Yes? So we are still in a situation where we can learn how to be so fluid, how to enter into being, and to find that open, permeable, spacious interbeing to be our true refuge. Okay. So you see, my teaching went completely differently than what I thought. But that's what the moment seemed to ask for. And let's meditate a little bit. That's always what I do when I don't know how to continue. So, no, I would know, but let's relax. Let's relax the conceptual mind and go further into just being. Now, as I share this meditation with you, I sit with you in the refuge, okay? You can join. You can join with your personal way of feeling your way into that which is the safest inner experience. And yes, it is very good to close the eyes, to have all your capacity to feel that inner space. If you wish, you can lean against the Buddha, as if the Buddha were a tree. Just lean. You can also imagine it is Tara, the female expression of those qualities. When you find that refuge, or when you go come close to it, you will notice that your body reacts. You will notice that, wow, there is a feeling of relief in your system. So I encourage you to go with that feeling. And to use your creative mind to do what is possible to offer you that deep respite, we say in English, the deep relaxation. There's a Mahamudra text which is called The Cure in the Nature of Mind. So go to the place of cure. We come now to a more structured part of the teaching. I encourage you to take notes. Feel free and feel encouraged to do that. Several times a day, I ask for 3 times an hour of teaching. So I will give these more spontaneous parts and then a little bit more structured presentations. Both of them will be there. Yes? Let's go back to where I started yesterday. View, meditation, action. When you remember the Eightfold Noble Path, it starts with the view. And the view here is the wisdom aspect. It is the understanding of what we are doing. This is the view. Now, I just gave you an instruction on the view by explaining the refuge. Okay? This was an instruction on the Mahamudra view. The Mahamudra view is that everyone has a completely pure mind. Yes, I have worked even with a person who has been a partisan in a war, a guerrillero, who has killed more than 100 people. And there too, the Buddha nature is there. This is what we call this pure, basic nature. It's called Buddha nature. You can call it any name. It is just that potential to be free and awakened. And this potential is in each one of us. And this is part of the view. It is nothing new. The Buddha was the same. What was the Buddha's teaching? He meets a person and he says, you can awaken exactly the way I awakened. And, you know, this is how you can try. You know, that was his saying, 45 years. Everyone he met, he made no exception. Everyone has that potential to be free from all this unnecessary suffering, all these veils, what clouds the mind, and to have all the inner qualities awaken. And this view is the Mahamudra view of the ground. Every one of us, we have this basis, this ground, of that true nature which is beyond all the confusion in our mind. Whatever clinging, fear, and so on is present, the ground is not touched by that. And again, from my experience, also as a doctor and therapist, then I let you know that this ground, this Buddha nature, is present in the depths of psychosis and depression. No doubt. This is what we actually work with when we help people to find out of these difficult mental states. Some of you have probably experienced that. And it is that ground nature, that basic nature, that we place all our trust in. The rest is what we call in Mahamudra superficial confusion. We call them superficial temporary stains, like something which makes us actually we are on the brakes, huh? We are not living our full potential. It is something which, in the sense of klesha, it is what hampers us. The afflictions, they are like a handicap. So this ground of being has no handicaps and is never tainted by anything of that going on the surface. So the whole purpose, and this I'm still with the Mahamudra view, is to make this ground of being become present so that it shows more and more in our interbeing, in our relationship with the world. And this is making the ground become evident. The ground becomes the fruit of the path in the end. And the path is the practice in between. The path is what purifies all our unnecessary confusion, all that tightness, the self-protection, all of that. Yeah, to find out of that. That's the path. And the fruit is when then the work is done and it's free. Yeah, this is ground, path, and fruit. Ground Mahamudra, our Buddha nature. Path Mahamudra, to unravel the Buddha nature, to make it shine forth. Fruit, Buddhahood. It's just the Buddha nature fully present. Very easy to remember. I hope you take notes. Ground, path, fruit, Buddha nature, Bodhisattva path, becoming the awakened being that we basically are already, and then fruit, Buddha. Yeah, so the Buddha is not outside of ourselves, it's inside. So that's maybe good, we should take the Buddha away again, because Buddha is not outside. And it is the experience of awakening inside. That's what we call the actual Buddha. So Mahamudra is just as any other Buddhist teaching. Buddhist practice is about this inner awakening of that which is already there. So part of the view is that to make this fruit come about, we better don't do any effort. Effort? Mm-mm. No, no. This is not a path of effort. Any effort we put forth just shows that we don't trust our basic nature. I hope you didn't do too much effort in your life, in your spiritual practice so far. I was trying everything to become enlightened. I felt like a lion in a cage and bumming my head against the wall of dualistic clinging. Until also this guy relaxed, and then everything happened by itself. Okay, so Mahamudra is about letting it happen by itself. Trusting, always going with the trust, going with the blessing, going with actually a devotion to the basic nature of all sentient beings. We are not devoted to the gurus. The guru is Buddha nature. And the outer gurus are simply the ones who show us the path to the inner guru. I hope you can follow. Yes? The true refuge is the ground. The Mahamudra of the ground. The basis. The path is to enter the ground, to let the ground unfold until it is completely unfolded, and that we call the fruit Mahamudra. And that for all sentient beings. For no one excluded. No one. Even those who throw bombs on us. No one excluded. Temporarily, maybe a little bit protected. Temporarily, no way to talk. But in the long run, making wishes, maybe in next life we can have a better connection. Yes? Like this. Keeping it a little bit open. Not impossible. Yes? Not impossible. Just a little corner there for a possibility that perhaps in a different life we can connect in a better way. Yes? So no stress, also with compassion. Don't put stress into your system to try to be compassionate. Just keep it open. Don't put fire, don't put oil onto the fire of the emotions. Don't do that. Accept the emotions, become like you say, this permeable, this spacious, non-clinging awareness. So actually then next thing of the view, it is the trust in the self-liberation of all mental phenomena, of all phenomena, to put it short. All experiences are self-liberating. nothing to do to make an emotion, a fear, liberate. You know, don't try to liberate your fears. Just don't do all these things to avoid it, you know, to stop it, to break it, to solidify it. There's a lot of not to do. A lot of teachings of what we don't engage in, so that the natural process of self-liberation can show. Let's think back to those times we don't remember when we were born. We were born, this little baby. Then we grew up and, you know, we were an infant. And then we were a child. And you know, what would be your guess? How many thoughts have gone through our mind since then? How many emotions did we have since then? Did we do anything for them to pass? Mostly we were trying to cling, but even with clinging they would pass. We can't even stop something changing if we cling. It's not possible. Even clinging doesn't stop the self-liberation of all these phenomena. All our experiences pass on. And basically what they do, while other experiences arise, the one which was just the experience of now dissolves in its own nature. It doesn't go anywhere. It has never existed as a thing that needs to dissolve. It's basically showing that it is the coming together of different circumstances, different forces in mind. And these forces, they don't come together in exactly the same way in the next experience. So, finished with the previous one. Next one arising. And this is where one wonderful aspect of our mind comes into play, which is very useful under some circumstances, but not so useful in others. You might call this memory. Memory is excellent in order to compare one experience with the next. But emotional memory, clinging to what I have lived, can be helpful as a source of learning, and can become very oppressive, not being able to let go. Oh, he insulted me, you know, I remember, maybe you had a brother, like I had brothers, he said this, you know, he pushed me down the staircase, and then, no, I was the one pushing him, actually. But then, if you don't move on, you don't live the new situations freshly anymore. It is something is staying on. And this is actually narrowing our own receptivity. That's the problem. We're not as receptive anymore. Even with people that have nothing to do with the previous situations, nothing whatsoever to do, even with them, we're not as receptive. And this is called veil. It's an emotional veil. It's the effect of difficulties that we have lived, with which we identify. The identification solidifies the memory, solidifies the past. And this solidification, this clinging to what we have lived and what we are living now, this influences the way we live the next situations. And unfortunately, due to that, people, when they grow up, they become less flexible. Most of them. Except if they begin practice, you know, like we are doing together. So we work on our flexibility. And this we do principally by not putting the brakes on. This is the most important thing. It's nothing to do really, but it's to, like, I love to do bicycling, so you have the hands on the brakes, yes, and it is actually this movement, you know, it's going almost by itself, and I can relax this constant tension on the in the yeah, you know, it's like relaxing the hands in the same way we relax the mind. Right now, hey, it's possible. We can always put on the brakes again. We know how to do that, okay? We can protect ourselves as soon as we need. If it's going downhill too fast, we put on the brakes. But that we need to identify the situations when it's not necessary, because this is where we can relax. So there's many situations in our life, most of the life, we can relax because there's no danger there. And our system needs to know that, needs to be able to identify, now I can trust. Now it's possible. Now it is actually possible to just be. And then with my wisdom, which is the good side of memory also, I also know when I have to be careful. There are certain quarters of the town, for example, of a big town, where you walk through carefully, right? You pay heed. It's like you take care. And then you know when you come out of dangerous zones, you know, okay, now I can relax. So we need to offer our system, our mind, we need to offer these places to relax. And this is part of the view of Mahamudra, to discover more and more situations as possible areas of relaxation. You know, probably from the Vipassana teachings, just the same way that the so-called observer, this observing tendency, is very much a controlling tendency also. So Mahamudra highlights that point of relaxing the control when it's possible. And the Mahamudra path, the practice, is about more and more situations where we can trust, where we can relax, and we trust that natural receptivity. For example, you and I, we would meet, and I would not be in this mode of what do I have to do now to have a good relationship. We would sit and we would relax. We would relax and see what happens, like that. Trusting that from basic nature, from basic receptivity, which is compassionate, which has the capacity to understand, something will arise. So this is in couple relationships, we do the same thing, we relax, we trust. And the more we trust ourselves, then we find that we can often also trust others. We find more and more situations in which we can go trusting without needing to do something. So actually, this is the meditation part. The view is that everybody has this basic healthy nature, and that whatever arises in that basic mind is self-liberation. The path is the path of trust and of becoming familiar with that in more and more situations, which means this is the action, this is the activity, because situations means that we are interactive. So in situations, like me doing it with you right now, I'm doing it on the spot, this is an activity, you would agree? I teach, so to speak. But this teaching, for me, is not tiring because I don't need to teach. I let myself be guided by your reactions, what you offer to me as a resonance. I go with that, there is a spontaneous answering to that, and I can trust that basic nature to do that. It has done that all these years. So this is what is called becoming familiar. The meditation is to be familiar. You know, that's the original meaning of bhavana, what we translate as meditation. Bhavana in Sanskrit, or gom in Tibetan, means to become so used to, so familiar with your own mind. That is what meditation is. Meditation is to be familiar with how it is. And that carries over in the activity. Completely familiar with how our mind is, we enter situations, we allow ourselves to look into the eyes of people, a little bit looking in their hearts also, and of course allowing them to look in my heart as well, into my eyes. So there is this trust, it carries over in the activity. And then the words arise from that. You don't have to worry about them. They come. And they are accompanied always by the wish to serve the situation, to serve the overall situation. So this is how the view of interbeing continues in a path of interbeing. Yeah? The meditation where we open up the senses and we actually practice this interbeing, we allow more of it to happen. And we see there's no harm in having the eyes open. There's no harm in having the ears open. No harm to feel everything in the body. It all flows through. And we continue with that in activity. View, meditation, activity are actually not separate. What we understand as the view, this is what we practice as a meditation, and what we practice as a meditation becomes our activity. They are one. Three aspects of the same practice. And the second link in the Eightfold Noble Path, remember, is motivation, is our attitude towards the world. Yeah, is the, I don't know which word you would use yourself, but I translate it often as motivation, intention, yes? Now the intention in the Mahamudra practice, this is called bodhicitta. This is this term I used yesterday already. The intention is that every sentient being awakens to its own basic nature. That's it. That's the motivation. You have certainly practiced already the four Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurable qualities, love, compassion, joy, equanimity. It is that. That is the second aspect of the Noble Path. And that inspires our meditation. So if we practice Mahamudra, it means that we always practice with bodhicitta, which means the four immeasurable qualities, always present. That's why every breath, every in-breath, every out-breath is actually breathing like a Buddha. To practice bodhicitta means to enter the mindset of a Buddha. And that's naturally kind, it's naturally receptive, it's naturally creative, it's naturally trusting, naturally generous. You know, all these qualities, they are there to practice the mind, the citta of bodhi, of awakening, means to practice our ground nature. To practice that what we truly are. Not creating an artificial Buddha. No, no, no. You know, the Lila Buddha will be a different Buddha than the Tema Buddha. Because we have different conditioning, different upbringing, different genes, different, you know, experiences. But the basic qualities of Bodhi, of that awakening, they will be the same, the basic ones. And then the individual expression is just as different as each one of us is different. We will all be different Buddhas. So to practice bodhicitta is not modeling ourselves after an external image. It is going to that inner source, this inner refuge, this bodhi-mind, and to allow it more and more to express itself. That's then the activity. This is then how we speak, how we act, how we earn our livelihood. You know, the next three steps of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay? This is activity. And then we have three more missing. Huh? If you have studied a little bit, you will know which ones are coming now. There is the aspiration, there is this striving, you know, this that which directs the mind, then the mindfulness, and then the samadhi, you know, the entering, the absorption. Now, the aspiration is, like in every Buddhist practice, is to always go towards what is most wholesome, what is most helpful. That's where the intention goes. Yeah, this more precise, we're talking now about the practice situation. In the practice situation, the sati, remembering what is wholesome, yeah, remembering where to direct the mind. It directs us to what is most wholesome. And one application of that was this morning when I said, okay, I don't know you very well, but I know it's very helpful to start the day with contemplating this precious human life with all its potential and develop gratitude about that, which is helping us to practice. So that is one way of practicing sati. We direct the mind there, where we can feel this is inspiring, this is opening, it's helpful. And we don't leave the mind in unwholesome or not so helpful ways of functioning. The sati brings the mind towards what is wholesome. And samadhi, the last one of the list of the eight, yes, is actually then abiding in the wholesome. Samadhi or jhana is defined as abiding in that which is deeply wholesome. And it changes. It changes with time because what is wholesome in the beginning is not necessarily wholesome later on. So the most wholesome, and this is typically Mahamudra then again, is to abide in bodhicitta. It's a bodhicitta samadhi, which means not a samadhi where someone is intent on helping others, you know, kind of the savior syndrome or something. No. To abide in bodhicitta means to abide in the mind of awakening. That is the real samadhi we are going for. To abide in a centerless, open presence, not creating an artificial I that wants to save the world. No effort. Abiding in that openness, completely available, fully receptive to the world, just like the Buddha. That's the way we are going, okay? So I walked you through the Eightfold Noble Path, explaining it a little bit from the Mahamudra perspective. Huh? That was, maybe you could follow, maybe not. I'm usually overdoing with time. I see it's it's really just 1 hour which has passed. That was the time that was possible, right? Good. Then no time for questions. Otherwise, I would have invited your questions. We do that later in the day. Okay? And now I pass over to Lila. Whatever you like to say, whatever you feel is convenient, everything is welcome.
Yeah, so we've been sitting here for 1 hour and we are going to practice the walking meditation soon. I just want to suggest maybe taking a phrase, a word, an intention from what you heard. No need to be stressed about remembering or not remembering, but something that touched you, even if you don't understand it fully. And let it, I would say, percolate in the system, like coffee, in a coffee machine. Let it run in your system. Maybe water will be a better simile. Maybe it's the bodhicitta aspect. Maybe it's the vastness of mind. Maybe it's the centerless aspect, the openness. Maybe something about the view that touched you. Maybe the aspiration. Is it possible to be so open? Maybe not now, but maybe later, just leaving a little bit of space for that. So when we go out now practicing walking meditation, we have 45 minutes for that. Just allow yourself to dive into the practice without straining, without putting an effort that is centered in the I, in the me. Maybe even offering the walking to the world as an act of dana. So with each step, again, Thich Nhat Hanh comes to my mind, we are massaging the earth and the earth massaging us back. With our feet touching the ground. Maybe it can remind us of the ground that Lama Tilman just spoke about, our true nature. And even if we feel so far from it, it's just a feeling, just a thought. It doesn't mean it's true. Let the thought be, let it go, and keep cultivating the path into our true being. And it's possible. Yeah. It's really possible. So please enjoy walking. Take the time to connect with life in that way. And maybe even just now and again bring into mind, where is the walking taking place? What is walking? Is it in the step? The many steps? Who is the one who's walking? Just like homeopathic doses of these beautiful Nagarjuna's questions, pointers. Every time the mind goes away, we just very happily coming back to the here and now, the only time, the only place right now that exists.